Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. The high cost of travel for extracurricular activities in Sitka's schools has been an ongoing debate for years. Now the school board is going to take a hard look at whether travel costs students and parents more than just money. At its regular meeting Monday night, the board officially opened the question of whether Sitka's students and the teachers who coach them spend too much time away from class. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
For some kids, it's a trip here and a trip there. For junior Ryan Apathy, who participates in cross-country in the fall and then in drama debate and forensics through February, it can be consecutive weekends of competition. If those events are out of town, Apathy and his teammates will likely miss Thursday and Friday of school for travel. And, oh, Apathy is also in music, which accounts for 3 out of a total of
10 trips this year and missed 22 days.
Apathy, nevertheless, is succeeding in school and excelling in the activities he's involved in. Sitka's school board is concerned that Apathy and kids like him are the exception rather than the rule.
Had a math audit that said by the time a high school student is a junior, they're already a year behind in math in terms of the amount of time they have been in class if they're a student that's been involved in activities.
That's Board President Lon Garrison, who's interested in exploring a policy implemented recently in the Unalaska School District. The policy limits students to 20 absences from school per year for activities.
It's not a policy coming from a district that's just kind of doing ho-hum. It's a policy coming from a very remote district that deals with, logistical issues like we do. But it's also very high performing.
The Sitka School District doesn't have a policy in place that specifically limits absences like this. It covers only excused and unexcused absences. Setting a hard cap is new. Speaking from the audience, Sitka High Activities Director Mike Vieira wondered if it would have any impact. I would be shocked, he said, if we had more than a handful of students who missed 20 days. Student Board Member Jessie Bartels, in her final meeting, wondered if the policy was missing the point.
We already have a policy where if you have a certain grade in a class, then you can't go on a trip, and I think it's the student's job to maintain that.
Bartels is also in a lot of activities in which she excels, and she keeps up her grades. She and Ryan Apathy get that they're not necessarily the kids the board is worried about, but they both have insight into the problem.
Is it true that for some kids, being in class is a make-or-break thing for their grades?
Absolutely. If you're not there to hear, what the content of the class is, you're not going to do well on the tests or the content that the classes you're required to pass in order to, get the credit for the class.
I know at the beginning of the year, a lot of teachers were gone due to coaching activities, and it was tough not having them there and needing them, and the sub couldn't really answer any questions. And I don't want to be unfair in saying that I think there should be more restricted days for teachers and students, but I think it is a detriment to the student body as a whole if the teachers are gone as much as the students are.
School Superintendent Steve Bradshaw agreed to collect data on how many students are gone, for how long, and for what reasons before the board reopened the question of a hard cap on absences at a June work session. Bradshaw has always expressed a belief in whole student education. He has reservations about boxing students and educators into limits that may somehow backfire.
I'm real concerned when we go down that path of setting hard set policy, because normally it ends up trapping the school board and the superintendent and the principals more so than the students sometimes, so you've got to be cautious with it.
The Sitka School Board will hold a work session on attendance Tuesday, June 4th, 7 p.m. in the district office boardroom. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
At the onset of World War II, the territory of Alaska was seen as too big, too remote, and too sparsely populated to defend. That is, until it was attacked by Japanese forces. In response, a few thousand residents came together to form the Alaska Territorial Guard. Once the war was over, the Guard disbanded, and those who served went back to their daily lives. But they were never formally released from duty. Decades later, these Guardsmen are now finally getting their discharge papers. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that some notable Alaskans are among them.
When Dennis Egan opened up some official-looking mail before heading into work last week, he wasn't expecting to find his late father's discharge papers.
It was this formal U.S. government, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I've been summoned to jury duty. So I opened this box, and there it is. And I just broke down. I couldn't. In fact, I didn't even come in.
Dennis, a state senator who represents Juneau, knew that his dad, Bill, was part of the Alaska Territorial Guard. Before serving as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention and then as the state's first governor, Bill Egan had flown planes during World War II. He even earned a medal for making it through a kamikaze attack. Dennis figured that his dad had been released from service when the war ended and that the papers had just been lost back in 1964.
I didn't have a clue. I thought all this stuff was just destroyed in the earthquake. In their home in Valdez.
Bill Egan isn't the only member of the Territorial Guard not to have his discharge papers. He's one of 6,000. After the war, the Guardsmen were thanked for their help with the effort, but there was no formal paperwork documenting that their service had come to an end.
They were busy. They weren't worried about. They were trying to protect us. They weren't too worried about fancy medals and crap back then. You know, and then things just were overlooked.
Back in 2000, Congress passed a bill to rectify that. It requires the Secretary of Defense to issue discharges to everyone who served in the Territorial Guard. Those papers let living guardsmen apply for benefits available to every other veteran of World War II, and they also carry a lot of emotional significance for family members of guardsmen who have already passed. Ferdy Brown directs the Alaska Office of Veterans Affairs, and he's in charge of the effort. With so much time since the war, it's been tough tracking down every member of the Guard. He says that frequently, relatives of deceased guardsmen don't even realize that their family members served. That hit home at one ceremony he was involved in last year.
What caught me off guard was the crew chief that was on the Black Hawk helicopter that is currently serving in the Alaska National Guard stood there and did not realize that his grandfather had served in the Alaska Territorial Guard. He didn't know that we were presenting that medal to his grandfather when we flew in.
Brown says that the Territorial Guard was critical to the war effort and that there's no reason to treat them differently from veterans in other states. They came from 100 different communities across Alaska, stretching from Ketchikan to Barrow, and they served without pay. They picked up downed pilots, they reported on the movements of Japanese ships, and they shot down fire balloons. Dennis Egan wishes he knew more about that history and his father's time in the Territorial Guard. Bill died in 1984, and he didn't really talk much about the war when he was alive. That's part of why it was only this year that Dennis learned that his dad had never been discharged. He says that even though it's been so long since World War II and so long since his father passed, he's glad to have these papers now and thankful for the connection.
An enormous sense of relief, an enormous sense of closure.
In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A Southeast Village Native Corporation wants to export its cultural tourism expertise. It's opened a consulting business to build on more than a dozen years in the business. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Huna Totem Corporation has more than 1,300 shareholders with ties to the Tlingit Village, about 40 miles west of Juneau. It places cultural interpreters on board cruise ships sailing the ancestral homeland of Glacier Bay. It also presents educational programs at the National Parks Lodge, the jumping-off point for many visitors. Now, those efforts have a different name and goals.
Alaska Native Voices is going to be an expansion of what we are currently working on.
Mark McKernan heads up what Huna Totem used to call its interpretive services department.
We're going to now provide consulting services for other cultural interests, Native groups, small communities, and what have you, will provide these services to them to help them answer the big questions of how do they start, where do they start, and what goals should they be aiming for.
A number of other Alaska Native corporations and tribal entities use cultural tourism to make money and employ shareholders or members. But McKernan says others are looking for help.
What we have learned and what we can pass on is just as relevant in Southeast Alaska as it would be in Costa Rica, for example, or somewhere in the East Coast or the Midwest.
Alaska Native Voices began operations earlier this month. McKernan says it has no formalized consulting agreements yet, but several groups have expressed interest and are discussing options. Rosita Worrell, president of the Juneau-based Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, says Huna-Totum is well-equipped for the business.
I think they have the experience, they got the professional background and business experience in it, and I think, you know, they've done a great job in terms of, you know, trying to educate people about their culture and their history, and meanwhile making a profit.
Huna-Totum's heritage guides are scheduled to be on about 200 cruise ships this year. That includes the Holland America line, which sails large ships, and Alaskan Dream and Lindblad Expeditions, which operate much smaller vessels. McKernan says cultural tourism programs need to tap traditional knowledge and not just be another stop on the road.
We do consult regularly with elders and others in the community and develop resources for these cultural guides to be able to grow and expand their knowledge base.
Huna-Totum operates its own shoreside attraction, Icy Strait Point, which expects about 135,000 cruise passengers this year. Traditional culture is part of most of its excursions and programs. McKernan says Icy Strait managers could also consult with other businesses interested in similar developments. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
For links to Huna-Totum's Icy Strait Point attraction and its cruise ship heritage guides, visit our website, kcaw.org. Sea Alaska says it's awarded about $405,000 in post-secondary student scholarships for the upcoming school year. Scholarships are based on scholastic merit and class standing. They were given to 350 Sea Alaska tribal members, shareholders, and descendants. The scholarship program is funded through an educational endowment created by Sea Alaska and revenue-sharing provisions under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And that's all for Raven News. If you've missed any of our stories or would like to hear them again, visit us online at kcaw.org. You're listening to KCAW Sitka.